is Wednesday, November 20th, 2024. We have three matters on our calendar for oral argument, the first of which is State of Minnesota versus Beth Marie Kuhlbroth. Counsel, I know you are both very familiar with our procedures. I'll just remind you, we each have 15 minutes for your argument. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. It's important that you state your name and identify the party you represent when you begin your argument, because we are making an audio recording of this. That is the only recording that is permitted for today's hearing. And with that, counsel for appellant, you may proceed.
Good morning. My name is Leah Graff, and I represent the appellant in this matter, Beth Kuhlbroth. Kuhlbroth appeals her Swift County conviction for first-degree sale of a controlled substance. The question presented in this case is whether the district court erred in considering a single factor, the result of a single trash pull, to conclude that there was a substantial basis for probable cause to search Kuhlbroth's home. Because there is no drug residue in the garbage exception to the totality of the circumstances test that governs the determination of whether a search warrant is supported by probable cause, the district court erred and should have suppressed the evidence seized during the execution of the search warrant. The first issue addressed in the briefs is whether the search warrant is facially valid. Probable cause to issue a search warrant requires a fair probability to believe that contraband or evidence of a crime would be found in the location to be searched. Here, Ms. Kuhlbroth's home. This test unquestionably requires a consideration of the totality of the circumstances, and we are limited to consideration of the information presented in the search warrant affidavit.
And we review the totality de novo, right?
The totality, well, so.
That, and I mean, the district court, we defer to fact findings, but to the extent we then look at the circumstances, we undertake a de novo review, do we?
The totality, I think that the totality inquiry, yes, is a review of the totality in the warrant affidavit. There is, you know, the review on appeal, or by even the district court here reviewing the issuing magistrate, of whether there was a substantial basis for probable cause, which is sort of a modifier here. But substantial doesn't mean nothing at all, or it means substantial. And we submit that here what the district court did in reviewing the search warrant was not consider the totality of the circumstances, not consider whether under that totality there was a substantial basis for probable cause. What the district court did in reviewing the basis for the search warrant was say, because there was drug residue in the trash, that was the substantial basis for probable cause. The court did not consider any other circumstance and cited McGrath for the principle. Drugs in the contraband in the garbage provides a substantial basis for probable cause. That is a categorical ruling that is inconsistent with many decisions of this court, the Supreme Court of this state, and the U.S. Supreme Court that return to a totality test time and time again.
Go ahead.
If this court does a proper totality test, doesn't that include the information in the warrant application about Kuhlbroth's daughter and her prior history?
Certainly that information is included within this court's consideration of the totality of the circumstances, but it is our position that it adds really nothing to move the needle in terms of finding a substantial basis for probable cause here. And there's a couple of reasons. First of all, in terms of any timing information, right, we have phrases like on prior occasions or in the past. That gave nothing to the issuing magistrate in terms of that judge's ability to determine the timeliness of the information. It also indicates only prior arrests and prior contacts at the property. There is nothing in the application to say that Ms. Kuhlbroth's daughter was arrested there for any drug activity, or that the prior contacts were because she was a frequent visitor there or lived there, or because she was, frankly, they're in violation of an HRO. We just don't know. So that information is vague and uncertain. It does not give the issuing magistrate anything in terms of building to a point of probable cause.
To be specific, what about the fact she's got two active warrants, arrest warrants that are drug related, and then that in combination with the drug residue in the garbage Don't those two things work together in a way that could reasonably allow the issuing judge to determine that there's probable cause?
I don't think so, Your Honor. And again, I think that the drug residue in the garbage tells the court only that indicates, should suggest that there was drug use in the residence at some point on some prior occasion. We don't know how frequent the trash pickup was. We don't have any information to suggest that SH's active warrants were at all related to her conduct at the property. We don't have any information that says any of those prior contacts at the property were recent enough.
But when all the warrant application needs to do is establish a fair probability, right, that evidence of a crime could be found in that home. Don't you prove beyond a reasonable doubt any particular thing at the probable cause stage, right?
That it is not a beyond a reasonable doubt requirement, that is for sure. But it is not just suspicion. And I think it's important here to keep in mind that the limits that the Minnesota Supreme Court has placed on inferences from evidence of use alone. It just reiterated this point in State versus Garding, cited an Oregon case talking about evidence that somebody is a drug user or has recently used drugs says very little about whether there is ongoing possession. So the hump that has to be overcome here in terms of the limit on that inference has to provide some indication of ongoing activity. We don't get that from the information about SH. We don't know if her activity at the residence has ever involved drugs. We don't know that the use evidence in the trash indicates any ongoing activity at the residence. And I want to be careful to point out here that unlike, I think, any other warrant I've ever looked at, this warrant details nothing about Miss Kuhlbroth, who is the resident, whose residence is to be searched. Nothing about her criminal history. Not that she has one at all, let alone that she has any history herself of drug-related activity, use, sales, anything. It is silent on that.
But the warrant is for
that.
The residence, right? Not specific
it
to
is
Ms.
For,
Kuhlbroth.
It is for her and her residence. But that's why the link between anything found in the trash is tenuous to say that then there's some ongoing activity in the residence by someone who is not alleged to have been ever involved in any drug-related activity. There is no clear link. We think that undermines a substantial basis for probable cause. And I think, too, if this court is really persuaded by the information regarding SH, then it has to then look at the Franks issue. If it thinks that this is really compelling and bolsters what's found in the trash, well, then you find out that the affiant omitted the information on timing, that these warrants, and therefore any in connection or contact with the police at the residence, was substantially old by years.
Just before we get into the Franks
yes.
issue, how do we grapple with the fact that we have a case, the Papadakis case, then that also says that the trash pull could be an independent and substantial basis for probable cause?
So I don't believe that Papadakis answers the question here. So a couple reasons. If you look at the issue in Papadakis, it was not whether the trash pull alone was a single factor substantial basis for probable cause. The court doesn't say that. The challenge was whether the informant who identified there being a lot of short-term suspicious activity at the residence, whether that information was independently corroborated. If you look at the syllabus point that this court made on this issue in Papadakis, probable cause existed to issue a search warrant when an informant's tip stated there was frequent foot traffic observed at appellant's residence and residence names were provided. Police and police verified the information, the informant's credibility, and cocaine residue was found in the appellant's garbage. That is far from a rule that we have an exception to the totality of the circumstances inquiry that allows a substantial basis for probable cause anytime there's drug residue in the garbage. So we are not asking you to do anything differently than what the court did in Papadakis.
Do we have to go down the same analytical path that the district court chose? I mean by that, do we have to say, yes, this trash pull in and of itself was sufficient probable to establish probable cause? Or can we say, look at the totality of the circumstances? I think you answered earlier that we do, in fact, look at all of those circumstances.
Yes.
So why would we reverse simply because the district court followed an analytical approach that you assert was incorrect?
Well, the argument is two-part, Your Honor. It's that the district court followed an incorrect analytical approach, and that under the correct analytical approach, what we are left here is almost no helpful information at all about a non-resident person who is accused of low-level drug charges, and no information about my client's criminal history or involvement in drug activity, and a single time, a one-time trash pull that reviews evidence of discarded items related to drug activity that field test positive.
And
one
you would,
time.
You would agree, though, that there was other materials, including the pipe that tested positive for methamphetamine, in a different trash bag that was pulled at the same time?
I would say that the warrant affidavit is not clear about where the items were. It calls out the fact that one of the items that field tested positive is in a bag with basically mail with my client's name and address on it. As to the other items, it's not clear where they are. That being said, the lack of detail there is important because it doesn't, the affiant, the veteran task force agent here doesn't say this is high volume of materials suggesting ongoing activity or sales or distribution. What the affiant gets to at the end of his statement is, here's what I believe about users. The inference he wants the magistrate to follow is, I think users keep drugs in their home. And the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that's not an inference that's warranted. We don't just assume that use means you keep drugs in your residence so as to support a search warrant for that residence. And it's particularly problematic on this record where there is nothing in the affidavit that says Ms. Kuhlbroth uses drugs, has ever been known to, or be involved in any criminal activity whatsoever. So unlike any other case that I am aware of that has come out of this court applying Papadakis or Papadakis itself, the warrant here is very sparse. And we just don't get to that substantial basis on this record. And you certainly don't get there if you, again, find some of the information about SH persuasive, but then I would ask the court to look at the Franks issue and acknowledge and hold that that was a reckless omission that was material, given that that's the only other sort of sliver of possibly persuasive information here.
What was the omission?
The omission, so at the omnibus hearing.
I know you've identified three, but now you're talking about which one?
I'm specifically identifying the omission as to the age of SH's active warrants. The fact that she had been a fugitive for, I believe it was approximated at 2019. The agent testified that it was a number of years and that they were substantially old.
Does it matter when the arrest warrants were issued if they're still active? I mean, doesn't the active status make them fresh? I mean, in other words, it might allow the issuing judge to say, oh, she's on the lam. She's been avoiding law enforcement for a long time. And sometimes when people are on the lam, they're engaging in more criminal activity and so on. I mean, doesn't this provide a reasonable basis to contribute to the probable cause analysis?
No, I think what's important here is not that the warrants are active. What the information that respondent has stated on appeal is sort of helpful to the probable cause question about SH is the idea that she has a connection to the residence. What that omission would have told the issuing magistrate is that any connection to the residence is very stale. And there was no investigation to try to figure out if SH had any recent contacts with the residence. What
does it make a difference? It's her mother's residence, right?
Well, it certainly makes a difference because the warrant isn't for SH and it isn't for...
It's for the residence.
Right. But there's no allegation that she has ever resided there at all. Again, the allegations are very, very thin here. It's tempting to read into this a strong connection, but that is not what the affiant says. Prior contacts at the property. That's not even in the house. He says property. And I think we have to take the affiant at his word here in terms of the limited information he did choose to provide to the issuing judge. And, you know, it is a very, very vague assertion that SH is connected to the property.
In terms of your Frank's challenge, which is what you devote the majority of your principal brief to, what do we make of the district court's finding that, in fact, nothing in the record shows that affiant made misrepresentations for material omissions that were done in reckless disregard of the truth? Don't we have to review that for clear error?
The recklessness question is reviewed for clear error, and I see my time is almost up, but if I can explain here, that's a conclusory finding. It is, the district court judge then points to nothing in the record to support that it wasn't reckless. And we have very clear case law from the Minnesota Supreme Court that says we do not approve of omissions about timing. And we have, a 10-year veteran drug task force agent whose exclusive job is investigating drug crimes, and he doesn't note that the active warrants are years old. That's problematic, and that's reckless.
Thank you, counsel. You will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for respondent.
Good morning, Your Honors. Good morning, Counsel. And may it please the court, my name is Ed Stockmeyer. I'm an Assistant Attorney General appearing this morning on behalf of Respondent, the State of Minnesota. This court should affirm the conviction for first-degree controlled substance crime because both of appellant's challenges to the search warrant fail. On the Four Corners challenge, there was a substantial basis for the probable cause determination. And on the Franks issue, none of the three alleged omissions were material. My plan this morning is just to sort of go over some of the points appellant made in the reply brief as well as in the argument this morning. I'll start with a question that Judge Wheelock, you asked about there being trash in, or there being evidence of drug crime in multiple different bags. Appellant argues that that's not what the search warrant says, and we just have a disagreement about what the search warrant says on this, so let me walk Your Honor through why I think the search warrant does establish that there were that there was paraphernalia and drug evidence found across multiple bags. So the affiant listed sort of three categories of facts, and I'm looking at page 2 of the warrant application here. The first category was the corner cut baggie tested positive for methamphetamine, and these are numbered facts. So the affiant said fact 1, fact 2, fact 3. Fact 2 was the other evidence of drug crime, the other paraphernalia, the snort tubes, other baggies, and the glass pipe that tested positive for methamphetamine. And then fact 3 were the residency documents that were addressed to Ms. Kulbroth and had her home address on them. And then the affiant went on to say, and I'm just going to read here, it should be noted that item 1 was located in a tied-off garbage bag, which also contained item 3, the residency documents. So from that, I think we can pretty fairly infer that the second category, category number 2, which is the other evidence of drug crime, were not in that same bag. So that's why we think that the search warrant application provides a factual basis to infer that there was evidence of drug crime across multiple bags. And that's important because if there's if you have multiple bags coming out of your house of trash and more than one of them contain evidence of drug crime, that's some basis to suspect that there is an ongoing drug crimes going on with this house. Now, what appellant says about this on pages 8 and 9 of the reply brief is that the officer didn't draw that inference that I just drew about there being evidence of drug crime in multiple bags. He didn't state that inference in the application. But on that point, I'm just going to read Your Honors from Minnesota Supreme Court case, State versus Fawcett, cited in my brief. It's 884 Northwest 2nd, 380, page 385. And the Supreme Court said that the issuing judge is free to draw such reasonable inferences as he will from the materials supplied to him by, by applicants for a warrant.
Is it fair to draw that inference when this was from a single trash pull, even though there were multiple bags? I think in McGrath, there were at least three different trash pulls in sequence and time. So I think that may be part of the issue your opposing counsel has.
Right, and certainly in McGrath, it was over the period of 3 weeks, so three separate trash days they did the trash, and that's certainly, I'm not going to argue that's not stronger evidence of ongoing drug crime, although it was all we had was residue of marijuana in those cases. We didn't have the type of paraphernalia that we had here, including corner cup baggies. But in addition, I think if you just think about the way, and you know, we're allowed to make practical everyday inferences from the facts. That's part of Fourth Amendment doctrine. And if you just think about the way that people use trash, you have your trash receptacle in your house. You take out the trash one day, you put a new trash bag in it, and a few days later, it's full, and you take it out again. So I think there's at least some basis. Again, this isn't sort of like the smoking gun thing for probable cause here, but it's some basis that helps the totality of circumstances analysis to suggest that there is some drug crime going on over a span of time. So again, it's within 1 week because it's just one trash bowl, but I do think we have some temporal element here.
Is it problematic that there's nothing in the warrant that talks about Ms. Kohlbroth specifically being tied in some way to drugs as opposed to SH?
Not at all, Your Honor. I agree with some of the questions that were asked this morning about isn't the search warrant for the house? That's the connection that we're interested in. Is there evidence of a drug crime in this house? Not really too interested in which of the potential occupants or visitors in the house are associated with. It's with the house. And in this case where we have, again, evidence of drug crimes across multiple bags, where we have residency documents from this house addressed to Ms. Kohlbroth in one of the bags with the trash, I think we have a very strong link, both temporally and nexus-wise, to this particular house. And so I know that counsel makes some persuasive arguments about the staleness with respect to the criminal history of the daughter, but that's not really the thing that's giving us the nexus or temporal connection to the suspicion here. It's the fact that on the day of the application, in the trash associated with this house, we found actual evidence of a drug crime. And so that's a more direct link, both temporally in terms of the location to be searched, to this house.
Do you agree with the district court that that's enough, that we don't have to look beyond those circumstances to make a determination about whether there was, the issuing magistrate had a substantial basis for concluding there was probable cause?
I'm going to come at that from two directions, Your Honor. First, I agree with Ms. Graff. This is a totality of the circumstances analysis, and I encourage the court to look at all the facts. And I do think we're reviewing the issuing judge's decision, not necessarily the district court's decision. But having said that, I do disagree with appellant's reading of Papadakis. And let me walk your honors where that disagreement is. So I think appellant's argument is really that Papadakis is a case about corroborating the tip, that all the facts in that case and the analysis have to be viewed in light of this is all going towards corroboration of the tip. If you think about what the tip was in that case, I actually don't think that reading makes much sense. So the tip in Papadakis was there was foot traffic in and out of this house. And then I think the informant also provided the name of the resident, which the police later confirmed that was the right name. So I just think it's odd to say that when in Papadakis, when they found evidence of a drug crime in the trash, that the only relevance of that was to corroborate a tip that was just about foot traffic. That's sort of the inverse relationship that I think is the natural reading of the case, which is that the most direct evidence of a crime was a trash pull. That was its primary relevance, trash pull with mail from this house. And so I think that that's why this court then said that the results of the trash pull provided, quote, an independent and substantial basis for the probable cause determination. Again, I think it's odd to think of the result of that particular trash pull as corroborating a tip just about foot traffic. But even if you disagree with me about that, this court actually has published precedent, binding precedent, interpreting Papadakis. It's cited in the briefs. It's McGrath. And let me read, Your Honors, exactly what the court said in McGrath about Papadakis. This is from page, I think it's 543 of McGrath. This court cited Papadakis, and then in the parenthetical describing the holding, this court said, finding that a spoon with burn marks and plastic bag containing cocaine residue were sufficient to establish probable cause for a search. So that's binding precedent about Papadakis.
Is that consistent with our Supreme Court's repeated emphasis on a totality analysis?
I think the point I'm trying to make is I don't disagree that that we try to avoid sort of single factor tests. You know, you see one observation and you can always necessarily make a particular inference. It is a totality of the circumstances. Totality of the circumstance analysis. And as I explained in the footnote, there may be different cases where there are stronger reasons to suspect there's a nexus problem or a stronger reason to suspect that there is a staleness problem.
What about staleness here? I mean, it isn't just the staleness of the warrants in my mind. It's the vagueness about, yes, SH has been found in this house and she's been arrested in this house. When? We have no idea.
Correct, Your Honor. And the officer said it could have been as long as 3 years ago that the warrants had been outstanding.
Why should we conclude staleness is an issue here?
Right. So, but what I would urge the court is to not look at staleness with respect to individual facts. Like, this fact is stale, and therefore we have a staleness problem with the ultimate probable cause determination. The focus here is on the results of the trash pull. So the trash pull is there are drugs in the trash, there's paraphernalia in the trash, and it's the trash from that week, and there's mail in the trash addressed to that home. So the fact that there, if all we had was the criminal history of the daughter, I would absolutely agree that there's a staleness problem there. But we're really talking about drugs that were found on the day that the search warrant was applied for. And the daughter's history just sort of provides further basis or further explanation for inferring that there might be a drug crime going on. This is someone who has a known some history of using drugs. We don't know when, we don't know where, but there's some history. And so that provides maybe some explanation for why there's drugs appearing in the trash here. And then if you add to that fact, the fact that she has two outstanding warrants, it might make sense that maybe she's at her mother's home using drugs rather than her own home. But I don't necessarily disagree with Ms. Graff that if that were the only fact we were looking at, that I don't disagree that there would be a staleness problem. I just think that the gravamen of this warrant application is about the trash pull, and there's absolutely not a staleness problem there.
Mr. Stockmeyer, if I can ask a question about your forfeiture argument, seems to me that the assistant county attorney who submitted a memorandum sort of addressed this issue head on, a four corners analysis. Would you agree?
Oh, I agree, Your Honor.
And would you also agree the district court decided that issue?
I don't necessarily agree. I read the district court's order as really being focused on the Franks issue. Distinguishing a four corners challenge from a Franks challenge is a little bit difficult because a four corners challenge, you sort of have to assess the warrant to set the baseline for your materiality analysis in a Franks challenge. So there's always going to be an element of we're looking at the warrant and what does the warrant establish, and then what would have the omissions added had they not been omitted. On the forfeiture, you know, for me as an appellate advocate, if I look in a district court memorandum from the defense and it doesn't make a four corners challenge, which is the challenge on appeal, I'm going to make a forfeiture argument in my brief. But this isn't a case where I think that we're not prejudiced by any forfeiture. And if the court doesn't want to go down that road, I'm totally fine with that. This is not a case where we're really hanging our hat on forfeiture. But I'm always going to make that argument when it's not made in the district court. And unless there are any further questions, I simply ask this court to affirm the conviction.
I have one more question, sure, if I may. Could you look at page 5 of the district court's order, please? In the middle of the page where the district court begins a new paragraph with the word absent, I just want to, I'll wait for you to get there.
I'm there, Your Honor.
So that sentence, absent any challenge to the propriety of the garbage pull, the discrepancies between the testimony and affidavit is not relevant. Do you think that's a correct way of analyzing the Franks issue?
I think when the district court made this point about relevancy, I agree. I'm not wild about the way it's phrased. And honestly, I do think the analysis in the order is a little thin. I sort of give reading that in the best light possible. I sort of interpreted that as being a materiality point, that these facts just in saying they're not relevant. I think the district court is saying they're not material to the probable cause determination. That's how I read it. If your honor disagrees, that's fine. Materiality is assessed de novo. So I think that this court can make its own assessment of whether those three alleged omissions were material without being tied by what the district court said.
Thank you.
And the one last point I'd like to make on materiality, in terms of recklessness, I didn't address recklessness in my brief. We haven't necessarily conceded that. The way I view it is that the materiality analysis informs a recklessness analysis. So like, for example, in McGrath, the omitted information was so material to the probable cause determination that this court said it was a reckless omission. So that's sort of why I didn't have a separate section addressing recklessness in my brief. I do think materiality should be the focus of the Franks analysis here. And that's how I asked the court to analyze the issue. Thank you.
Scrap, you have the last word.
Thank you. I'm going to go back to the beginning of respondent's argument and just point out a couple of things in terms of what are the inferences to draw about what was in what bag, and how frequently or sort of how immediate or recent any use must have been. So number one, there's no information about how many trash cans or trash receptacles are in this residence available. So the idea that just we know how trash was being collected in the home and can make some assumptions about that is not supported by what's in the affidavit. Number two, respondent talked about, well, we know this was from this week. This was a weekly, suggested we know this is a weekly trash bowl. We're talking about rural Swift Falls, which I believe is a unincorporated village in Minnesota. The affidavit does not say that this is a weekly that was placed out for its weekly pickup. It says it was placed out for pickup at the normal time. We don't know if that's once a month, once every 2 weeks. We don't know that. So trying to sort of build to a probable cause based on this sort of compressed timeline and this volume of information that's just not in the affidavit is not warranted here. If there were things in multiple bags, we still don't have a high volume. There is nothing, there are not multiple pipes. There is just nothing here to suggest anything more than discarded evidence of use. Melted bags, one broken pipe, a corner cut bag that tested positive. As to, you know, the information about SH, I want to remind this court that the state's position in district court was that all of that information was not legally relevant. On appeal is when the respondent has said that that the information about SH is helpful to the probable cause question. As to the Franks issue, I do want to say that I think this court should not collapse the recklessness and materiality question. I agree that really the issue here is materiality. That's the focus of the district court's analysis. I think it sort of brushes off the recklessness question, but they are separate questions. And in McGrath, they said that it was a reckless omission, but not material. So they are two separate questions.
And again, then how do we deal with our clear error standard of review given the district court's finding that it was not a reckless
omission? The district court sort of says that all in one step. Whether there's really a factual finding there is not very clear to me. It's in the conclusions of law, but to the extent there is a determination there that it wasn't reckless, that is clearly erroneous. It is not supported by the record at all. Again, you have a veteran law enforcement officer omitting from the search warrant clear information that the warrants that were active for this non-resident person who the state is arguing shows some connection to the residence is years old. That means that if she had been arrested by law enforcement, the warrants wouldn't be active anymore in the recent history. So it's consistent with the standard of recklessness, that if this is issue, if this is information that the issuing magistrate should have had before it to be able to assess probable cause, and they didn't include it, and they should have known as an officer that that's the type of information issuing magistrates need to have, timing information, and they left it out, that's reckless. Then we move to materiality. Then we are left with stale information about a non-resident and a one-time trash pull that reviews evidence of use on some prior occasion in the home of a person who is not alleged to have any involvement in any criminal activity whatsoever. That's not probable cause. That's our position. And I think also, Your Honor, Judge Johnson referred to, you know, well, is this a, do you agree this is a totality test? You know, what do we do here with this issue of single factor or totality of the circumstances? And respondent is saying, and, you know, this is a totality test. Because that's the law. But you cannot say this is a totality test, and at the same time, binding precedent makes this single factor rule the day. Those cannot be the same. Those both cannot be true. Either it is a totality test, or this court is going to adopt a exception to the totality test that says, if you find drug residue in the garbage, that's enough to get a search warrant. That's what this case boils down to. Both times respondent defends the district court's decision, that's where they land. And that's an incorrect application of the law, not only because of the legal test that controls, but because of the facts in this record. And on that basis, we've asked.
What if, hypothetical, if I may, what if an officer goes into a home, say, for a different reason, emergency aid, something else, and sees in plain view drugs spread out on the coffee table? And then goes back to the office and drafts a warrant application based solely on, I saw drugs on the coffee table, and drug paraphernalia, a pipe, et cetera. I mean, wouldn't that by itself be enough to establish probable cause?
You know, I guess I won't necessarily agree that it's enough to search the entire home without more information about why they were there, who was in the home, who owns the home, where the items were. I mean, there would presumably be some additional investigation. You know, again, if you had that scenario and the homeowner is a known drug user who's known to associate with drugs, who's known to have been arrested previously, that gets you closer. And there's something there too that's happening, which is a very contemporaneous view of use and something going on inside the residence. We don't know when the trash was thrown out. I think there's an exhibit that shows the mail that they and the positive tests. I think it's 158, and it or exhibit 11. Yes, omnibus exhibit 11, and the mail is from December. The mail is almost a month old, so there's a contemporaneous element there that I think is different, but we just don't have that here. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your helpful arguments this morning. We appreciate them. We will take the matter under advisement and issue our decision within the statutory 90-day. You know what is going on?